For 30 years, we've been negotiating one question, whether those that have caused this climate crisis will be held accountable and liable for their actions. And so far, they have refused to take responsibility. The founding principles of the UNFCCC of common but differentiated responsibility and the polluter pays have been watered down over decades. And sadly, we're seeing this today with negotiations around loss and damage, especially even after the horrendous impacts of the climate emergency this year, especially in Pakistan, Nigeria, and many other places. Till today, we are looking for, they're posing false solutions, temporary solutions that do not address the core of the climate crisis.
Well, that's what we're going to be doing all week, is addressing the core issues here. Who's responsible? What needs to be done? Ahmed Eldroubi is the Greenpeace Regional Campaign Manager for the Middle East and North Africa. That's right. All this week, Democracy Now! Is broadcasting live from Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, from the COP27 Conference of Parties, the UN Climate Summit. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkdine, Augusta Masai, Redzner, and Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Madura, Sam Malkoff, Tamari Asti, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Dennis Moynihan, Mary Conlon. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura. Offbeat sounds for talented listeners. Broadcasts every other Wednesday at 10 p.m.
There was heaven and there was earth.
Después de esa pieza, vamos a escuchar una comunicación simpática y cruel con Annie.
That's Dr. Zom's Stereo Obscura, every other Wednesday from 10 to midnight, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
Prison Pipeline is a radio program dedicated to educating the public about the Oregon criminal justice system. Topics include incarceration and reentry, addictions and mental health, elections and laws, victims' rights, and criminal justice reform. The program presents a unique understanding of the criminal justice system, addresses the root causes of crime, and challenges the status quo. It seeks to promote awareness and activism in order to foster a safer, healthier, and more just society.
Prison Pipeline airs on Monday evenings from 6:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland. Check us out every week. If you miss an episode, you can stream it later. Just go to kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. More info about upcoming shows and events related to the prison community can be found on our Facebook page, Prison Pipeline. Be sure to like us.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler asks for $27 million to start his camping ban, an international climate summit inspires local action, and Oregon sheriffs say they won't enforce new gun control restrictions. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 14th, 2022. I'm Michelle Coppola. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler says he needs $27 million to start up his sweeping proposal that would ban unsanctioned camping and build mass encampments for homeless Portlanders. That includes money to see what city properties might be suitable for the sites, plus salaries and benefits for city outreach workers. Building the first three of six sites would cost $4 million, and $12 million would be the bill for the first year of operating the three sites. The entire project plan is estimated to cost about $10 billion, and Wheeler has asked for help from the county and the state with no response yet. To get started, Wheeler wants to spend $27 million as part of the Fall Budget Monitoring Process, or Fall Bump. The city only has $30 million in excess funds to work with before next July, and there are already a few multi-million dollar projects that they've committed to. This includes $9 million to restore the structurally unsafe Kirby Fleet Maintenance Facility and $6 million to replace the electrical service in the Justice Center. The fall bump is typically reserved for emergency needs that arise outside of the normal budget process. The city will hear public comment on the funding proposal and vote on the issue and other fall bump requests this Thursday, the 17th, at 2 p.m. Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week recognizes the struggles that many across the country are going through. In Oregon, events to help out the local community are planned in Eugene, which has one of the highest homelessness rates in the country. Eric Tegedoff has more.
As the cold weather settles in and some families make plans for the holidays, others are recognizing Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week this week. Hiba Hamad is the University of Oregon Chapter Chair for the Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. She notes that Eugene has one of the highest homelessness rates in the country. Hamad says her organization is highlighting some of the services available for people struggling on U of O's campus, and also putting together medical kits for people experiencing homelessness in the community.
A lot of houseless folks are requesting medical supplies because, especially as it gets colder, when they get cuts and bruises and things like that, and they can't take care of it, then a lot of them end up getting really bad injuries or even, unfortunately, pass away. That's been a recent issue.
Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week was founded at Villanova University in 1975. Groups in more than 700 locations across the U.S. are holding education, service, and fundraising events this week. The issue of hunger especially extends to U of O students. A report from the 2020-2021 academic year found that 22% of students were food insecure, more than twice the national rate. Hamad says with the increased cost of goods, such as groceries, more students are considering applying for federal food benefits from the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP.
A lot of students were hesitant because even if they were struggling, they were like, I don't want to take away from other people. I don't know if I am struggling enough. But I think especially as everything is getting more expensive, it's really starting to affect students.
Hamad says the university is helping students out with this issue, including with produce drops and a free student pantry. She says they're also currently working on creating SNAP benefit workshops to help students apply for the program. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Activists gathered over the weekend in front of Pioneer Courthouse as part of the Global Day of Action, focused on the Global Climate Summit, COP27. COP27 is the annual United Nations Conference of the Parties on the Global Climate Crisis. The Global Climate Summit continues this week, and activists gathered in support of human rights and climate justice. Members of international solidarity organizations spoke out in downtown Portland in support of those impacted by the climate crisis in the Global South. Jesse Braverman is an organizer and member of I Chirp Us, the International Coalition for Human Rights in the Philippines. Braverman said, quote, Oregonians should know that this year's COP27 is held in Egypt, one of the world's most brutal military regimes that has targeted environmental researchers and activists. The U.S. sends over $1 billion annually of our taxpayer money to Egypt. Braverman continued, quote, Egypt holds captive over 60,000 political prisoners, with 24 new prisons built since the 2013 coup. Torture frequently results in the death of inmates. Yet the marketing videos and official logo for COP27 greenwash this polluting police state as a happy, environmentally friendly place. Greenwashing and the need for loss and damage reparations and debt cancellation for the Global South countries were highlighted by the activists. They say that since the three nations are overwhelmingly responsible for harmful emissions and many other nations bear the brunt of the impacts, governments that caused the climate crisis should contribute more substantially to the solution. Voters in Montana rejected the Born Alive Infant Protection Act measure that was on this year's ballot. Opponents say that ballot measure was misleading and unnecessary. Lawmakers referred it to voters to protect infants in rare cases when a baby is born alive after an abortion. Eric Tegedoff has the details.
A Montana measure that would have implemented harsh penalties for medical providers who did not give life-sustaining care to newborns was voted down last week. Lawmakers brought forward the so-called Born Alive Infant Protection Act for the exceedingly rare cases where a baby is born alive after an abortion or born severely premature. Opponents say it was misleading and unnecessary, since infanticide already is illegal. Hillary Ann Crosby with the No on LR 131 campaign says there are tragic situations when infants are born with fatal health conditions. Families can make choices in these situations, such as to hold the infant or baptize and read last rites. But she says LR 131 would have mandated life-saving care, which would have meant taking an infant away from its parents.
We're certainly excited, but more so just relieved on behalf of those providers that would have been torn between, do I honor and respect a family's wishes, or do I obey a law that I know to be cruel and unethical?
If the measure had passed, healthcare providers found to have violated the law faced fines up to $50,000 and 20 years in prison. While the measure has been lumped in with other abortion measures across the country, it was referred to the ballot by the 2021 Montana legislature before the Dobbs Supreme Court case allowing states to decide on abortion. It would not have directly affected access to abortion. Crosby says, unfortunately, the lawmakers that crafted this legislative referendum did not consult with the people who would have been impacted.
They should have reached out to these experts. They should have reached out to these families to better understand what kind of support they need and what kind of laws just further traumatize them. And I really hope that that was a lesson that they took away, and that you cannot legislate what you're not even willing to try to understand.
Even with the Dobbs ruling, the Montana Supreme Court has ruled the state constitution protects abortion access under its right to privacy. However, now that Republicans have a supermajority in the legislature, lawmakers could move to change this in 2023. Crosby believes the no vote on LR 131 should be a sign that Montanans don't want this kind of change.
We do really think that LR 131 sent a pretty clear message that Montanans value our privacy and we value our private medical decisions. So hopefully they'll take that cue and they will trust and respect and support Montanans' wishes. But if not, we'll be there to remind them.
For Big Sky Connection, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Control of the U.S. House of Representatives still remains to be seen, but Democrats' chances of holding on to the chamber are getting slimmer. Locally, two important House races were called over the weekend. In Oregon House District 5, Republican Lori Chavez de Remer was declared the winner over Jamie McLeod Skinner. Chavez de Remer is the first Latina to represent Oregon in Congress, and depending on how close the race is in Oregon's new District 6, she could be joined by Andrea Salinas in that honor. For the 5th District, though, it's the first time since 1997 that the area has been represented by a Republican. In Washington District 3, which covers much of southwest Washington, Marie Glusenkamp Perez, a Democrat, has been declared the winner over Republican Joe Kent. Republicans have held that district since 2010, and it was a surprising win for Glusenkamp Perez, since many pre-election predictions said the district leaned Republican. As you may have heard, Measure 114 passed in this most recent election. It creates a system requiring a permit to purchase a gun in Oregon and bans ammunition magazines holding more than 10 rounds. That will soon become law. But the sheriff of Linn County said she won't enforce some of its parts. Linn County Sheriff Michelle Duncan said that section on magazine capacity is a non-starter in her community. Last week, she posted a message on Facebook saying, quote, "I want to send a clear message. The sheriff's office is not going to be enforcing magazine capacity limits," end quote. The post has already been shared more than 10,000 times. In the comments, some applauded Duncan's announcement, while others questioned how a law enforcement agency could choose which laws to enforce or selectively ignore. Duncan appears to expect that the initiative will be the subject of a lawsuit. She added, quote, "This is a terrible law for gun owners, crime victims, and public safety," end quote. Duncan was also on the ballot this month. She was appointed sheriff in January to fill out the term after the previous sheriff. According to votes counted near the end of last week, she had a substantial lead. Some 70% of voters rejected Measure 114 in Linn County, by the way. Sherman County Sheriff Brad Lowry said before the election that he would not arrest someone for possessing or buying high-capacity magazines. And some other Oregon sheriffs have called Measure 114 unconstitutional, but stopped short of saying they would not enforce it. A spokesperson for the Oregon Department of Justice did not respond to a public radio request for information about how the agency views statements from law enforcement officials who are threatening to ignore state law. Oregon sheriffs have, in the past, pledged not to enforce certain gun laws that they do not personally like. In 2013, at least 8 law enforcement officials, again, including the sheriff in Linn County, sent a letter to Barack Obama saying they would not enforce unspecified new federal gun laws. Anthony Johnson is a spokesperson for the Yes on 114 campaign, and he said, quote, "We look forward to working with elected officials, law enforcement agencies, and other stakeholders to ensure effective implementation of this life-saving community safety policy," end quote. Nearly 70,000 people in Oregon have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. It is National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month, as well as National Family Caregivers Month. Eric Tegedoff has more.
November is National Alzheimer's Disease Awareness Month, and importantly, it also coincides with National Family Caregivers Month. The progressive brain disease is common in Oregon, with nearly 70,000 people living with Alzheimer's, according to the Alzheimer's Association. Lenny Steinberg is the program director for the organization's Oregon and Southwest Washington chapter. He says caregivers play a crucial role in the lives of people with the disease.
It can be all-encompassing and certainly over time increase as the disease progresses. Caregivers are experiencing a huge emotional impact.
Alzheimer's disease is the 7th leading cause of death in the United States. Earlier this month, the Alzheimer's Association's Oregon chapter gathered for the 24th annual McGinty Conference on Alzheimer's, Dementia, and Aging, the group's first in-person meeting since the start of the pandemic. Steinberg says results from a study last month on a drug called lecanemab are promising. A clinical trial found that the drug reduced the rate of cognitive decline by 27% in a study of participants experiencing the early stage of Alzheimer's.
This is one of the most exciting pieces of research coming out in many, many years. And to be able to get on top of something like this at the early stages is just extremely promising for so many folks.
Steinberg adds that people in need of support resources for someone in their life who has Alzheimer's or dementia can reach out to his organization for referrals or consultation about care. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, post-Roe abortion access from The Response. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. Then at 6:30, Prison Pipeline. At 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather, clear with wind gusts up to 22 miles an hour and an overnight low of 34. Tomorrow, sunny, clear, and a high of 53. Today in history, in 1960, Ruby Bridges becomes the first black child to attend an all-white elementary school in Louisiana. The quote of the day is from Egyptian diplomat and 6th Secretary General of the UN, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, who was born today in 1922. He said, quote, "Democracy is an objective. Democratization is a process. Democratization serves the cause of peace because it offers the possibility of justice and of progressive change without force." Programs known as applied baccalaureate degrees are not the traditional college track, but rather designed for older, working students. While enrollment has dropped elsewhere, these programs have actually soared during the pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more in Washington.
Enrollment in Washington State's community and technical colleges has suffered during the pandemic, but there has been one bright spot. Programs known as applied baccalaureate degrees actually saw gains from before COVID-19. These degrees aren't like traditional bachelor's degrees. Ranging in fields from healthcare to manufacturing to cybersecurity, applied baccalaureate degrees are designed for older working students. They're also set up according to local job needs. Valerie Sunby is with the Washington State Board for Community and Technical Colleges.
Those really strong ties directly to employment is what we think is driving that enrollment to remain consistent, even when other enrollment is kind of seeing a bit of a decline.
While enrollment in community and technical colleges fell by nearly a quarter between 2019 and 2021, enrollment in applied baccalaureate degrees rose 16%, according to the state board. Students in these programs often have two-year technical degrees, and the degrees can help them get promotions at their current jobs. Sunby also notes these programs are highly localized. For instance, she says some folks in teacher education programs start teaching in the districts where their kids are students. Sunby says that's a plus for those communities.
That community connection means that they understand the students that they're going to teach. They're invested in what's happening there and in the education there. So that highly local experience, we think, is really great for our students and also really great for those communities.
Sunby says because approval of new applied baccalaureate degrees is tied directly to the local job market, the demand for technology degrees is skyrocketing in Washington State. That's why her organization recently authorized 7 more community colleges to offer computer science applied baccalaureate degrees, on top of 2 that already offer it.
We really see this as an amazing opportunity, both to meet that workforce demand in our state, but also as a pathway to really lucrative careers for our students.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Catherine Cortez Masto and Mark Kelly win re-election to the Senate in Nevada and Arizona, clinching the Democrats' majority. With that story and more, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
And I am so grateful to every Nevadan who knocked on doors, who made phone calls, and who stood up and fought for our state.
Incumbent Senator Catherine Cortez Masto won re-election in Nevada, helping to clinch a narrow majority in the U.S. Senate for Democrats. She beat back Republican challenger Adam Laxalt by less than 1% after 5 days of vote counting. Cortez Masto has acknowledged that it was a hard-fought campaign, but called on Nevadans to have confidence in the Democratic process. The other win that locked in the Democratic Senate was that of incumbent Mark Kelly in Arizona. He defeated Republican venture capitalist Brett Masters by more than 5%. On Election Day, Kelly talked about unity and seeking solutions.
This campaign, for me, you know, it hasn't been about name-calling or dividing people. It's been about telling the truth.
With the midterm elections nearly over, the future of the January 6th committee remains in limbo. Republicans have said it would be dissolved should they win a House majority. The ranking Republican on the panel, Liz Cheney of Wyoming, says there's more work to do. Cheney has been sharply criticized in her party for pursuing the investigation, but she describes the midterm results as a vindication.
It was a victory for Team Normal. I think you saw many candidates who were reflecting sort of the election denialism. President Trump rejected, not all of them, and some races are still left to be called, but I think it was a really important and frankly hopeful outcome for democracy.
At the UN Climate Conference, COP27, U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry gave an update on the plans under negotiation. Some will have the U.S. partner with Japan, the European Union, and other countries on immediate cuts to total greenhouse gas emissions. Kerry says another proposed agreement is just between the U.S. and Norway.
We in Norway announced the Global Shipping Challenge with more than 40 concrete pledges from governments, ports, and others, private sector, to decarbonize global shipping.
When visiting the conference, President Joe Biden apologized for the U.S. pulling out of the Paris Climate Agreement under the Trump administration. Biden later traveled to a meeting of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations and announced a strategic electric vehicle partnership.
Through our new U.S. ASEAN Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Initiative, we're going to work together to develop an integrated electric vehicle ecosystem in Southeast Asia.
Former President Donald Trump says he'll make a big announcement November 15th. Many expect Trump to announce his candidacy for president in 2024. At this time, it remains unclear if President Biden will be running for president again. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
A Cherokee delegate is ready to serve in a promised U.S. House seat, and the Cherokee Nation is calling on Congress to honor its commitments. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Cherokee Nation is calling on Congress to honor the commitment made by the U.S. government in the 1800s to seat a non-voting delegate from the Cherokee Nation in the House of Representatives. Cherokee Nation citizen Kim Teehee has been chosen as the delegate. Rhonda Lavaldo recently spoke with her about a national campaign started by the Oklahoma tribe to get her seated.
The government and the Cherokee Nation reached an agreement through a treaty nearly 200 years ago that committed a Cherokee delegate a seat in the House. The Senate ratified it, and President Andrew Jackson signed it into law. The tribe says the long-standing agreement does not expire. This fall, the Cherokee Nation, its citizens, and its allies mobilized across the country to call on Congress to act before Congress adjourns in December. Teehee spoke on the efforts to do that.
We've had a lot of questions, and we've had to go back deep into historical documents, Federalist Papers, to answer questions. But we've not heard opposition. We've just heard a lot of questions, and that thankfully we're being asked and we're being afforded the opportunity to respond to as well.
Teehee also talked about her priorities for the Cherokee Nation, like adequate funding for services and infrastructure, improve health care, increase access to the internet, but also to take on action on a language bill to help preserve native languages.
Language preservation is a huge, huge priority for Cherokee Nation. And so we actually have a bill pending in Congress now called the Durban Feeling Native American Languages Act. And it's named for the late Durban Feeling, who was what we call our modern day Sequoia, who revitalized and really enhanced and set the foundation for all the language preservation efforts we do today.
Teehee has served as the tribe's vice president of government relations and was a senior policy advisor for Native American affairs during the Obama administration. A House committee is set to hold a hearing on the Cherokee Nation delegate on Wednesday. This is Rhonda Lavaldo for National Native News.
A program that aims to train Alaska Native people to become rural pilots opened a new facility recently in Anchorage. Emily Schwing reports.
The new hangar is now the central spot for students interested in pursuing a career in aviation. CKT owner and certified flight instructor Jamie Clays told a crowd of nearly 60 people there are holes to fill when it comes to aviation in rural Alaska.
There's a lack of service there due to pilot shortages, due to a mechanic shortage.
CKT Aviation contracts with Alaska Excel to provide pilot training to students from communities off the road system. Alaska Excel offers additional intensive courses beyond general high school curriculum to students from rural Alaska school districts. Lori Evan graduated from high school in Upper Kalskag last year. She first started taking classes in Excel's aviation program when she was in seventh grade.
I actually flew a plane, like, unexpectedly, and I flew it all by myself, and that, like, inspired me to come and do more, and it was my goal for years.
Lee Ryan is the president of Ryan Air, an Alaska-based airline that serves most of Western Alaska. He says he wants to hire pilots who grew up just like he did, off the road system in Unalakleet.
And they understand the importance of safety, the importance of one foot in front of the other, the importance of navigation, situational awareness, the culture. They get it, right? So it makes it so easy to serve the people you're trying to serve. So it's like, it's the missing piece of the pie.
Ryan recently hired one commercial pilot out of Alaska's Excel program, and he's got his eye on the progress of at least one other. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Differences in dialects can make it tricky to communicate weather risks to Spanish speakers. So the National Weather Service has revised the Spanish terms for severe storms. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Spanish word for thunderstorm is tormenta, or if you're from Puerto Rico, you may call it a tronada. Tornado is tornado, but in Colombia, that term is used to describe a strong gust of wind, not a twister. So providing information about extreme weather to Latino immigrants in the U.S. can be hard, because people come from diverse places with different dialects. And in some countries, weather events like ice storms or hail are rare, so some immigrants may not know the risks or how to stay safe when they occur.
We can't encourage people to take action if they don't know, or we can't even describe the threat to them.
Joseph Trujillo Falcone is with NOAA's Cooperative Institute for Severe and High Impact Weather Research and Operations. He worked with linguistic experts to revise the National Weather Service's Spanish language terms for describing the level of risk posed by severe storms. He says the new standardized terms, which range from mínimo to extremo, can be broadly understood across dialects and clearly convey the appropriate level of urgency.
Especially as our climate begins to make different types of disasters a lot more concerning, we need to make sure that everyone's included in the disaster preparedness and response process.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, November 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegedoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact. Have a great evening.
System is in too many ways broken.
The way we see the world.